This is Christine Hoover from GraceCoversMe.com, and I want to welcome you to the By Faith podcast, where each week this season I'm talking to someone who is walking forward by faith, many through difficult circumstances. We're asking the question, how does God meet us in our deepest, darkest pain, and how does He turn that pain into beauty? There are a few things I want to highlight for you before we get started today. All of the podcasts in this season of By Faith have been conversations with people who are living out what I've written in my recently released book, Searching for Spring, How God Makes All Things Beautiful in Time. If you've resonated with the men and women I've talked with who say life has been hard in certain ways, but also that they've learned to see the beauty and goodness of God through those very things, Searching for Spring is a book for you. I hope you'll grab your copy today. It's my hope and prayer to encourage you in your own walking forward by faith. And also, just last week on my blog, I released discussion questions so you can gather some friends and discuss the book together. You can find those on my website, gracecoversme.com. And finally, before I introduce today's guest, one more thing. I will be releasing a podcast to close season one called Ask Me Anything. And when I say ask me anything, I mean anything. What do you want to know about life or ministry or faith or writing? It can be serious or not so serious. Whatever your question is, I want to know. You can submit it at the link in the show notes and look for that episode at the end of May. Okay, let's get to the show. Today, my guest on By Faith is BJ Garrett. Before I introduce BJ, you need to know that today's episode covers adult topics, and although not crass or crude, the subject matter is not suitable for children. BJ is a wife, mom, and grandmother, and in my conversation with BJ, she shares about her experience with sexual abuse, sexual sin, and abortion. She also shares about how she came to understand who God is, how she finally embraced His forgiveness, and what she'd want women to know who have chosen abortion for themselves. So friends, here is my conversation with BJ. I'm so glad to welcome BJ Garrett to the podcast today. Hi, BJ.
Hi, Christine.
I'm so glad to have you because I have heard your story and I can't wait for the listeners to hear your story as well. But before we get to that, will you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your family and what you do?
Yes, absolutely. So my name is BJ Garrett. I am a mother and a wife and a grandmother. I am the executive director for CARE, which is Christ-Centered Abortion Recovery and Education.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to you, BJ, because I've heard your story, I wanted other people to hear because I think a lot of my guests so far this season have shared stories about circumstances that have happened to them or have been outside of their control. And you have experienced that as well, but you also have experienced suffering because of your own choices. And so can we start talking, just tell us a little bit about your childhood and what you experienced as a child?
Sure, absolutely. So to begin, my early childhood is really, really, I have a lot of blackout areas. And I really can't explain that any more than just, it's almost like a snapshot, like an old slideshow of like black and white still photos. And those are how my early memories are. I believe, and I could be wrong. I mean, I never want to blame God for anything, but I believe that He's protected me from some memories. Mm. And they're just black areas in my life. And I remember enough of the ugly that I don't really dig deep to try to remember some of those black areas. Mm-hmm. But, I just remember lots and lots of, just ugliness and some abuse. My mom made a lot of really poor decisions. She was just not healthy, and which resulted in me and my sister, being kind of transported to different families' homes, in and out of like CPS care and just in and out. My mom was in and out of prison and out of jail, and she just made really unhealthy choices. Probably about the time that I was 11 is really when kind of my life started. And that's when we moved to Texas. We grew up very, very poor. I mean, I was kind of that child that, you know, your teacher listeners will know, you know, shows up with dirty clothes and clothes that don't fit, and they never have the school supplies that they need. Mm-hmm. That was my life. Mm-hmm. We often didn't have electricity or running water to take baths. I was that dirty little ragamuffin kid growing up, and which was hard socially, you can imagine.
Sure, yeah.
But so my mom pretty much just got to the season where she, I truly believe she just didn't know better. And that sounds kind of wacky to say, but she just did whatever she had to do to provide. And so she got to where she would allow men to have access to me to provide groceries or electric bills or whatever the need was in that season. That's what my price was. And so I hated my mom, Christine. I mean, I hated her. I wish that I could say that I didn't, but I mean, and even it sounds hard now saying hate, but there, I mean, that was not even appropriate for the as much as I despised her growing up.
Was she a single mom? Were you living only with her?
I was. When we lived with her, yeah, she was a single mom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this was when you were a teenage, like early
teenage early year. Early preteen, yeah, early preteen age. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, it was pretty rough. I remember one story. We had moved out. We had lived with my dad, my biological dad, for a short season when we first moved to Texas. And ironically, he was one of my very first abusers. And for so long, because I was in such denial that what he was doing to me was abuse, that, I mean, like, really, I've shared my story so many times, and it finally hit me that I would always say the first time I was abused was, and it wasn't my dad. But the truth was, is that he was my very first abuser that I remember.
But so that was your first abuser, and there were many more.
Yes.
So as you're moving into your teenage years and you're trying to make sense of your home life and who you are as a girl, as a woman, how people view you, can you walk us through where you were?
I was so lost. I grew up, I came from upstate New York from when I moved to Texas, and we had moved all around, but we were never in one school district for even a full school year up until this point. And so we moved to Texas, and I'm just, like I said, this little poor ragamuffin white girl. And the school that we moved to was predominantly Black, and which is not a terrible thing, but it was just culture shock for me. I had no idea. And it was a very low income school. And I mean, I was lost. I had no idea what a healthy home looked like. I mean, there was just so much drugs and alcohol and abuse and sexual abuse happening behind the walls of our home. And nobody knew that. But I didn't know how to express that either. Mm-hmm. And I mean, no one wants to be your friend when you're this broken, especially not the good kids, not the Jesus loving kids. Those kids their parents didn't want me coming to their home. And so I turned to the bad crowd, and that bad crowd that they were drinking and they were having probably abuse in their own homes as well. That's the crowd that welcomes you.
So where did that lead you as you're in your teenage years? Where does that lead you?
That led me to a path of destruction, because I was trying to numb the pain of my life by drinking and smoking pot. I became sexually active at a very, very young age. I mean, I learned at a very young age that sex is what gets you what you need, what you want. What I wanted was love and acceptance. And I learned that when you're, you know, a young teenager, and I'm, you know, 13, 14 years old, they want that too. And I mean, it was better to have sex with an 18-year-old boy than a 57-year-old man, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least he wanted me for me, which is stupid. He was stupid too. But in that brokenness, I was trying to fill every heartache of my life by these other things, by men, by alcohol, by just numbing the pain that was my life. Mm-hmm. And it's just a downward spiral. I mean, you know, one drink leads to being drunk the next night. And then, you know, you smoke a cigarette, next week you're smoking pot. And I mean, it was just, and it felt good. Of course, you wake up in the morning and you feel terrible. And then you have the added weight of everything you had just done. But in that moment, so then you just drink more, you smoke more pot, you just do more, you know, you get intimate with somebody else. Anything you can do to numb the brokenness and the heaping on of the brokenness that you're causing on yourself.
Mm-hmm. Was there a point where you looked at yourself and really thought about, I've reached a bottom. I'm unhappy with what I'm doing to myself now, because you've had so many things done to you, but now you're choosing to do things to yourself.
So for me, unfortunately, I got pregnant at 14 with my first child. And for me, that was my breaking point, because I knew that there was no way that I could be the mom that I had had. And so I did not have a clear idea of what a good mom was, but I knew what a bad one wasn't. So in my mind, even at 14 years old, I just knew that I had to stop everything that I was doing. I had to stop drinking, stop doing drugs, and get my life together to be a mom. And so really and truly, and I'm not an advocate for teen pregnancy or anything like that, but at 14, getting pregnant saved my life.
And did you have, so you had the baby?
I did. I became a mom 5 days after I turned 15.
Wow. And,
I dropped out of school. I got married to her father. He was a great catch, Christine. He didn't have a job. He didn't have a car. He had an
education. Oh my goodness.
But you know, but I, in my mind, and I, again, just, I was so young, but I just thought having a father, even a less than perfect one, was better than having a fatherless home. And so he pretty much didn't come home most of the time, but getting married to him rescued me out of my home life. And because even though I was a minor, I was married to an adult, which then made me an adult legally. So I was able to get a job. I was able to work. I dropped out of school. And so I would walk to work about 5 miles every day with my baby in her little stroller. And she would sit in the drive-thru while I would work. And then we would walk home at night. And sometimes my mother-in-law, who I love dearly still, she's actually my ex-mother-in-law now, but she would drive all the way from Winona, which is about 30 minutes, I guess, from where we live, and give us a ride home that, you know, in the evenings, because she didn't want us walking home alone at night. But I mean, that was my life for my early motherhood. Mm-hmm. And so our marriage didn't last. I know that probably surprises you, but it didn't. But again, I mean, I learned at such a young age that almost like you got to have a man in your life. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to fill these, what I know now, they were just Jesus voids in my life. And I did that with men. And so I quickly got into another relationship. I fell head over heels in love with this guy. I mean, for me, he had treated me better than any other male in my life. I mean, he told me I had nice eyebrows. I mean, which is, I know, isn't that so silly? But like, that's how broken I was. That's a simple compliment about eyebrows for all things swooped me off my feet. And so it was when I was, my daughter and I quickly moved in with him, and he was my forever. I mean, absolutely the love of my life. And I got pregnant with his child, and I was so excited. I mean, this time, like, he was a good guy. He had a job and a home and a car and like all of this stuff. Like, he was good, and he loved me, and he loved my daughter. And so this was going to be a great thing. And when I told him that I was pregnant, he said, "I don't want to be a dad." And when he said those words to me, it just broke my heart. Like, I mean, it just broke my heart. And all I could remember in that moment, it was just like a tunnel vision of a night with my dad in a drunken stupor in our living room, spitting in my face, telling me he wished I had never been born. And when this guy who I loved with all of my heart said he didn't want this child, all I could think is, there is no way I would bring a child into this world that would hurt the way I hurt every day of my life. Mm. And so we drove to Dallas, and I had my first abortion.
He took you?
He took me, yeah.
And how old were you?
I was 17.
Okay. I think for many women, they immediately began to feel the after effects of having made that choice. Some feel relief, but then they're flooded with other feelings. And I would love for you to tell us about that.
Sure. So, I can start with that day. We went into the clinic, and my counseling consisted of me sitting in a little bitty tiny dark room with a lady. I swear at the time she was like 150 years old, smoking a cigarette in this clinic, my. That's in my mind, my memory, and I'm sitting there bawling my eyes out, mm-hmm. telling her how much I want this baby, and her convincing me that I was doing the right thing because the father did not want him. And so obviously I had the abortion that day. We're driving home and I just cannot stop crying. The remorse happened before I ever laid on that cold table. I was so angry with him for not wanting our child and for not protecting me. And just the whole atmosphere of the abortion clinic was so cold and stale. And you're just rushed through like cattle. I mean, just one woman after another. And here I am. It's like this emptiness that in the pit of your stomach. I mean, because they had just taken my child from my body, and the reality of that. And I don't know, like going into it, if I just thought it wasn't going to be like, I don't know what I thought going into it, but just the reality that an hour ago I was carrying a child and now my womb is empty. And I had told them to do it. I paid them to do it. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. I was sick. I went through that next year of my life was just dark. I was so depressed. I cried every day. I was back to drinking pretty regularly. I was just so angry with the father. With everybody, really. And I just kept thinking, why didn't anybody stop me? Why didn't anybody tell me it was going to hurt this bad? And really, I put a lot of blame on the birth dad, because why did he not want our child? You know, why didn't he love me or this baby enough to just let it live? And so, yeah, it was pretty bad.
So what happened with that relationship?
Oh, it didn't last. I ended up getting pregnant again, and this time it was very intentional. And it's very common for women who are post-abortive to almost have like a redemption baby. I didn't have any kind of like weird things, like I was replacing that baby that I had lost through abortion, but I very much had the sense that I needed to fix what I had done. Mm-hmm. And the only way in my heart that I needed to do that was to have another child. And so even though I knew he didn't want to be a dad, I didn't care. I was obsessed with getting pregnant. And so it took me a little over a year to get pregnant again, but I did. And so when I was 5 months pregnant, I had come home from taking my daughter, my older daughter, who was 3 at this time, to preschool. And when I came home, he was in bed with another woman. And so, so I packed up and moved out and was...
And you were pregnant at the time.
I was pregnant at the time, yeah. So then ultimately there I was. Now I'm now a single mom of 2 kids. I've had one abortion, and I had a friend that said, you need to go work at the Gentleman's Club. They're always hiring. And so I ultimately went to a local Gentleman's Club, and I went in and I thought, there's no way I will ever do this. I'll just wait. And I walked in, Christine, and of course, as ugliness that was in my life, I was actually kind of sheltered, and I had never been in a club like this ever. And so there's like all of these topless women all around me and loud music and smoke and men drinking. And I'm like, what am I doing here? And they ushered me to the back, this back office, and I walked in, and there were just on this desk, rows and rows and rows and stacks, 8 or 9 inches high of money, ones, tens, twenties, $100 bills, so much money. And I was just like, oh my goodness. And I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I can do this after all, because I mean, it was very enticing to see the potential. And again, I just refused to allow my children to grow up the way I had grown up. And I associated that with being poor.
Okay. Yeah.
And so seeing all of this money, I just thought this is the answer. And so I went to work in the gentleman's club, and just as a waitress at first. And then they came to me and they had asked me to dance numerous times. And I was like, there's no way I can do that. And they came to me and said, we're having an after hours party tonight. It was all the big money men coming in. And would you consider just tonight, it's a private party. You can drink. Remember, I was still underage at this time, as far as drinking goes, but I could drink because it was an after party, you know, after hour party, and I would make a lot of money. And so I'm like, sure, why not? You know, okay, I'll do it. And by the end of my first set, I hadn't even taken my clothes off yet. I had over $1,000 and several shots of tequila. And I mean, the only way I can express that is that I was just completely high on the money. I was drunk on tequila and high on the money. And I didn't waitress anymore after that.
Mm-hmm. So you had already had your second child?
I had my second child. Yes. This was okay. after I had my son. And so,
so now you're fully entrenched in a lifestyle of sexual sin, really. I mean,
yeah, it really was. And so it was kind of like I had two lives. Like by day, I was this house mom taking care of my two babies, living life, you know, going on field trips. And then on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I would work at the strip club. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not an advocate for this, but I was making money. I was not on welfare. My kids had clothes and food and somewhat stable home. And I thought I was doing good. You know, if you would have told me then how deep I was in the sex industry, I'd have thought you were crazy. And I would see all of this prostitution going on all around me and drugs and all of this. And I never did any drugs while I was in the club. I did drink a lot when I had to dance. Because I almost, for me, like it's like I had to do something to get the courage up to get up there.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's so many different dynamics of that season of my life, because on one hand, it was like all of a sudden I had power and these disgusting perverted men could look and give me their money, but they couldn't touch me. So they couldn't harm me. And many of the men like that had hurt me my whole life. Mm. And so all of a sudden there's like this wall where they can no longer hurt me. Mm. And that gave me a sense of security and power but it also just like deepened my brokenness. Every song, every dollar, every shot of tequila, every moment of that season of my life, I got harder and more cold-hearted and just more broken.
So what finally broke that brokenness open for you?
Well, so it was actually in that season that I got pregnant by one of my customers. And so I would say I wasn't a prostitute because I would never take money for sex. But the reality was is that I would take the money on the stage and then sleep with them afterwards. And so that's how I justified it in my mind. But I got pregnant by one of my customers. And this time I never even told the man that I was pregnant. I had gone from that extreme and of brokenness and cold-heartedness that I just called up a friend. We never said a word. I just said, I need to go to Dallas. She never asked me. She knew what I was going for. She drove me to the clinic. I went in. This time there were no tears. I remember specifically asking them if I could see the ultrasound, and because they had to do an ultrasound before they could perform the abortion, and they told me no. And when they told me no, I just said, okay. And I took that as, I just convinced myself that because they wouldn't show me, I must not have really been pregnant. And that sounds so absurd now, but in my mind and in my brokenness and deception is a powerful tool. And so I just decided that was what happened. And so that day was completely wiped from my memory. It was just gone. It was as if that day had never happened in my life. I never talked about it to anybody, and it was buried deep. Hmm. And so you asked what brought me out of that. Well, I ended up re-meeting or reestablishing a connection with a childhood friend at my sister's best friend's wedding, and it was her brother. And so I started immediately dating who's now my husband, and so that's kind of what started the new season of my life.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how, so you grew up in a home with no, was I'm assuming there wasn't much religious background that you grew up with.
So actually that's kind of the crazy thing is that because of my mom and the way that she was, is we went to church often, but it was usually for who would help us. So whichever church was kind of paying this bill this month, that's the church we would join.
Okay.
And so, and every time we joined a church, I would get baptized, and it was, I mean, like a little, I mean, it was just all a scam really.
Yeah. So what brought you to the point of belief and in saving faith?
Okay, so by this point, I am married, and we're living life. We're two fallen sinners, but deeply in love, and we had a house fire, and ironically, the same friend that drove me to the clinic for my second abortion, we were talking one day, and she and I was just at rock bottom. I mean, absolutely at rock bottom. She said, "You need to get in church." And when she said that, it was like I just remembered these little childhood memories of going to church when there was a need. And though that was not the right thing, what that instilled in me is that when you're broken, you go to church. And so there just so happened to be a church across the street from where we had moved after our house fire. And I had taken a job at a little tea room, and they had surrounded me with Christian people. So literally on Saturday night, I was working in a strip club. I'm still married at this point. My husband hates me working at the club, but I'm like, I'm doing it. And then on Monday, I'm at this little tea room working as a waitress. So I guess for about a month, I had maybe more than a month, months, I was surrounded by godly people who didn't know my story, but they just love the Lord. And it was for the first time in my life I had ever been around that. Every other religious experience or Christian experience I had ever had did not end positively. It was not, I mean, I don't know if it was just prejudice because of my life choices, which I can't really blame them now looking back, but they were, I didn't have positive influences from people who love the Lord. And all of a sudden I'm just head, shoulders, knees, and toes deep into this environment of people that just love the Lord. And they were so much fun, and they were so real. And so they were the first ones that invited me to church. And the first time they invited me, I didn't go. I was like, oh, great, here we go. You know, it's all going to change. But then, like, I didn't want to come back to church. I didn't want to come back to work that next week, because I was like, well, they invited me to church, and I didn't go, and now they're going to hate me, you know. And so then they invited me to church again, and I thought, I'm going to go. And so I went, and I was like, oh my goodness, there's like a bunch of these Jesus loving saints. and it's really important to explain it. Like at that point, I always thought I was a Christian. I mean, like, especially because I did have some history of being in the church. And I don't remember ever not knowing that Jesus was real or that he was the Son of God. But there was definitely no personal relationship with him. I was lost as a goose. I mean, I definitely had a head knowledge of him, but not a heart knowledge. And how to explain the difference between the two, I can't do that, but there is a difference. And so, you know, here I am. I'm going to church. You know, I just know the Lord had pursued me, and here I am. And I go down to join the church like you're supposed to do when you are going to church. And when the pastor asked me if I needed to be baptized, well, again, just remember, I was naive and stupid and young, but when he asked me that, I just thought, well, duh, that's what you do when you join a church. You get baptized. Of course, because I had no real idea of what that even meant. And so when he asked me that and I said, yes, I need to be baptized, that led him to lead me through just the normal sinner's prayer. And I remember, Christine, when I was praying those words for the first time in my life, it was like I was just begging God to be real, to be true, and for all of this to be real. And it was. I got baptized a few weeks later. And you know, baptism is a symbolic thing about being buried with Christ and raised up a new creature. But when I was, when the pastor dunked me under the water, it was like I could physically feel all of that ugly being washed away. Every ugly thing that had been done to me, every ugly thing that I had done, it was washed away. And when he raised me up, I was truly a brand new creature in Christ.
So did your life immediately reflect that, or was there's some wrestling of, okay, now I have to obey, and that means I need to make some changes?
So initially I was all in. I mean, I was all in. I quickly began teaching the youth. I became a youth director. I went to seminary. I mean, I was all in.
That is all in. Yeah.
Yeah. I was all in. Like, I was sold out for Jesus. My husband quickly got saved right behind me. I mean, we were sold out for Christ. And it was really, I guess, a couple of years into that when the Lord began to work on my heart. I mean, because in my mind at that point, all of that past was gone. Like, I washed it away in the deep water of baptism, girl. It was gone. And I didn't want to deal with it ever again. And, but a few years into my walk with the Lord, he began to work on my heart. And I knew my husband didn't know my story. My own husband didn't know any of that. And the Lord kept telling me, you need to tell him. And I'm like, God, he'll leave me. Like, I have married him under all of these false pretenses. I am dirty, vile. Like, I can't do it. I just cannot tell him. And really, I mean, just our intimacy suffered. Every time my husband would touch me, I would just begin to cringe. It was like he was that dirty old man, you know, from 20 years before. And finally, just on a broken down night, I had gotten a babysitter. I just said, we got to talk. And I'm like the ugly cry, you know, bawling my eyes out. He's like, what is going on? But I mean, I guess at that point I had gotten to a point where I'm like, okay, God, even if he leaves, you're enough. And I just knew I had to tell him. And so I just came clean and told him all of it. Now in that, I had only told him of the first abortion again, because up until even for many years later, my second abortion was completely non-existent in my mind. But the Lord just healed our marriage, and he loved me and he embraced me. And,
can you tell us some of the repercussions that you were living with, the kind of that stuff you were keeping to yourself that you thought, I don't really need to tell my husband, but what are some of the things that you were feeling that you could, that were left over, that were still kind of there from both the sexual abuse and the sexual sin?
Well, I mean, that's a hard question. I mean, it's self-destructiveness. I mean, the sleepless nights, the nightmares, the smells. I mean, you smell bleach and you're taken right back to the abortion industry. You smell lime and I'm at the club stripping again. I mean, there's so many just triggers of memories. Like, and, I mean, like, honestly, it was my husband would come up behind me on a couch and just touch my shoulder, not doing anything. And it was just like, I would just shrink back in almost fear. And my husband has never laid a hand on me, never been inappropriate in any way. And so there was just all of these, the memories, the haunting memories. I personally did not, because this was, again, I'm a believer now, and the Lord had healed me so much from my past. So I didn't do some of the typical things like drinking and drugs, and I was married, and so I did not have more sexual promiscuity. But that's usually very, very common in most women, especially if they have experienced that post-salvation. So like for me, most of my big, big, ugly sins were all pre-Jesus. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so then when I got saved and I gave that to the Lord, even in a, you know, not really knowing what that looked like since, it was all before Jesus. So everything after Jesus, I didn't have any big major catastrophes that I had done to myself or that were done to me.
Mm-hmm. But can we talk about that? Let's talk about that, because I think A high percentage of abortions are done by women who would say they're Christians.
Yes.
There are many women sitting around us in our churches who have this secret. They've never told anybody. And I think there must be a very unique sense of shame that women who are Christians and who would say they would tell themselves they should have known better, that they, that if they tell anyone that people would reject them. And yeah. So can you speak to maybe to those women who are listening, who had an abortion as a Christian?
Well, first off, I guess what I would say is that you're not alone. The church is filled with men and women who have had an abortion. Often abortion comes out of fear, or even selfishness. And I say selfishness because it's like people can't find out. Many, many times we get wrapped up in a relationship that turns sexual, which results in a pregnancy. And as a Christian, we know we're not supposed to do that. You know, we're supposed to wait for marriage for sex. And we didn't. And or maybe we are married, but we had an affair or whatever. Whatever your story is, you get pregnant. And so to cover up the sin that resulted in the pregnancy, your only choice in that moment is to abort. And then you pile on that, those self-destructive behaviors. It's just like, you just keep piling more and more on. The abortion, which was supposed to wipe away and cover up that sin and make it all go away, just made it a bazillion times worse. And so I guess, and I'm not really answering your question, I guess what would I say to them is that you're not alone and that Jesus loves you. And yeah, you screwed up, but scripture tells us that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He didn't wait for us to get all of our sin done and laid out on a platform and then die for us. He paid for our sin before it even happened, including the sin of abortion, whether it was before you knew him or after you knew him. He has paid the debt for your sin, no matter what it is.
Right. I know people personally who have experienced abortion, and they have said to me, you know, I believed in my secret, when I held the secret inside, I believed that this was the one sin that God could not forgive. And so I would love for you to speak to that. And how did you come to an understanding that God truly forgave you for your abortions and your sexual sin?
It was hard. And I wish I could say that I took a magic spiritual happy pill and I woke up the next day and I was all better.
Yeah. I think we all want to do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, but that's not the way it works. I mean, so for me, when I really accepted God's forgiveness, it was through a CARE Bible study, and which is why I'm so passionate about CARE now. I had shown up to this Bible study, and the way we kind of started was everybody kind of gave a short synopsis of our story. And for the first time ever, the Lord opened my mouth about my second abortion. And as soon as I said it, I was just like, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. And the amazing care leader at that time said, BJ, you're here to deal with that second child you aborted. And I was like, no way. No, not ready for that. That night, I don't even know how to express it except for I remember I walked in, because you have your own private bedroom. And so I walked into my bedroom at the CARE Bible study, and I just fell to the ground weeping. I mean, just this anguish and this brokenness and this hurt and this hatred of who I was and what I had done just all came boiling out of my soul, and just truly weeping out, crying out to a holy God who was showing me that he loved me. And it was horrible. It was so painful. But it really just boiled down to me acknowledging the truth of what I had done, why I had done it, and then embracing his love and his forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Was there a specific truth that you remember really sticking out to you that helped you embrace that forgiveness?
Well, I mean, so in the environment that I was in, I mean, it's a room full of women dealing with the same things yeah. I was dealing with. And really just hearing, there's just something unique about hearing so many different ladies sharing their brokenness. Because I went into this weekend thinking, I'm the only one.
Right.
I mean, I was serving on staff at a Baptist church in my town with the secret sin of abortion in my life, and nobody knew it. So to go into this study thinking I'm the only one that can hurt this way, that can feel this way, that can, all of those things just piled on. And then you walk into this room and there's five more ladies feeling the exact same way. Godly women, women in women's ministry, pastors' wives, pastors' daughters, children of God that are still broken by this unforgivable sin and unforgivable for us. You know, we truly feel like God can forgive everything else, but I took the life of my child. That cannot be forgiven. But the truth is that Christ died for all sins. Mm-hmm. And just making that real and accepting that as truth. I mean, either he died for all of my sins or he died for none of them. There is no in between.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to really grasp the truth and the weight of that, I had no choice but to give him my abortions, both of them. Mm-hmm. And to trust him with that. Mm-hmm.
So a big step, it seems like, was acknowledging it to God.
It is. It is. And that's the hardest too, because yeah. as long as you keep it buried and deep, deep down inside and silenced, Satan has all the power, because he is telling you, oh, you're not good enough for this. Oh, you're not, you know, you're a terrible mom with the children that you have that are alive. I mean, he compounds all these. What are your friends going to think? And for me, because I had finally grown close enough to a handful of people that they knew of my first abortion, but never my second abortion. So even in this moment of intense healing from my heart, it was like Satan was saying, well, now what are you going to say? They're going to all think you're a liar. You had one abortion, but really you had two. And how are you going to explain that? And so he's constantly putting these doubts of destruction in your heart. And I wish I was more eloquent to explain it, but you just have to keep falling before the cross, minute by minute, breath by breath, calling on a loving, holy creator God who sent his son to pay for that sin. Mm-hmm. And in that moment and in those following days and weeks, that's what I had to do. Every time Satan would bring that back up to me, I'm like, you know what? It's not unforgiven. Christ died for that. And he has that now. Take it up with him. Mm-hmm. And it almost sounds silly to even say that, but I would have to with my own voice out loud, say, take it to Jesus. He's got that. Mm-hmm. It's no longer my burden. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that like, I mean, I can talk about my abortions pretty openly now. And I don't do it like, oh, yay, I had two abortions, because that would just be sick, because there's no celebration in that. But I can celebrate in the freedom of Jesus Christ and him taking the weight and the penalty of my sin, even the sin of abortion.
Absolutely. That's beautiful. I'd love to know how that translated to you thinking about forgiving the people who abused you. Was that kind of parallel working through that process?
So, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that the more that you're forgiven, the impact and the need for you to forgive is multiplied. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So as the Lord was continually healing my heart from some pretty ugly stuff, I mean, I had done some pretty ugly things. I mean, besides taking the life of two of my children, I did lots of ugly, self-inflicting wounds. In that process of being forgiven, I had no choice but to begin to forgive the abusers in my life. I mean, God gave me really precious moments to allow that to happen. And not everybody gets those chances. For me, they were very real. While my parents were both alive, I did have a chance to forgive both of them. Ironically, I was able to forgive my mom before I was even a believer. The Lord gave me healing with her, and I didn't even recognize what it was. Mm-hmm. But from my father, who was one of my primary abusers, the Lord broke his heart for him. And on his, we thought he was going to die, but he didn't. But on his deathbed, he accepted Christ as his Savior. And for 3 years, I got to watch my dad, who was probably one of the most vile men in America, honestly, at that point, completely be transformed by Christ. The Lord absolutely restored our relationship. I had a godly dad for 3 whole years and absolute forgiveness.
Did y'all talk about the abuse?
We talked about it initially when he first came into my life again, because we had been completely estranged for many years. But so when he first came back into my life, he called me weeping and apologized. The Lord was just beginning to pursue him in a very strong way. And he had not yet given his life to Christ at that point, but that's when he first came back. And the Lord just, I just forgave him. Really, probably before that, I had to forgive all of them, or I couldn't exist anymore. I mean, because, and I know this is kind of a cliche saying of, you know, unforgiveness is like drinking poison and expecting somebody else to get sick. I've heard that a bazillion times, but that's so true. Yeah. And as I am harboring all of this anger and vile thoughts and unforgiveness and hurt, I was the only one hurting from that. I mean, my dad was miles away, clueless that I was miserable because of the things he had done to me.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us when you say forgive, what does that mean?
That means for me that I no longer allow his actions to hurt me. I no longer hold the weight of his sin on my shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're saying you recognize it as his choice and his sin, and he's going to have to deal with that with the Lord. The Lord's going to call him to account for it.
Yes, but absolutely.
You hold no responsibility for what was done.
Yeah. For you. Well, and also forgiving my parents and my other abusers, you know, it was, I don't even know how to express that. I couldn't carry the weight of that any longer.
Yeah.
The memories are still there. I mean, I never forgot what happened. I never said it was okay what happened. Forgiveness is not synonymous with oblivious.
Right.
I mean, I can forgive my parents for the ugly things they allowed in my life or did in my life. But that doesn't mean I have to say it was okay, because it wasn't. It was sick things. Mm-hmm. But I don't have to carry the burden of what those things did to me. There's consequences to every choice we make. There was a consequence for my abuser's sin, and that consequence affected my life in very painful ways. And I can either hold on to those for the rest of my life, and I can age faster, I can self-destruct, I can keep having nightmares, I can numb that and try to hide it with alcohol and sex and drugs or whatever my, you know, numbing thing is, or I can trust God with my burden. Mm-hmm. And so, by his grace, I was able to just truly forgive and let it go.
Mm-hmm. And how have you developed a more healthy perspective on sex and who you are as a woman?
Yeah. So God is so good, girl. He is so good. And he completely restored the intimacy between me and my husband. Growing in his word and having amazing godly women pour into me and to teach me what pure sex is and pure intimacy is has been phenomenal. And so often we don't talk about sex in the church.
Yeah.
God created sex to be beautiful and holy and pure. And he also gave us the bounds to do that so that it's protected. And when we go outside of that, there's consequences. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they result in lots of ways. But when we go back to his perfect design of that, it's beautiful, and he wants you to enjoy it and to keep it pure. And you can do that with your spouse.
Mm-hmm. So how would you say that we've heard how God has redeemed you, but how do you think even he's now using your story to bring him glory and display his beauty? So he's taking something that is ugly and broken and restored it in a way that he gets glory from it.
Well, I think that people relate to real life stories, and my story is real, and there's a lot of ugly. But I hope, I mean, people listening obviously won't see me, but I hope that Jesus is radiated from me everywhere I go. And yeah, there is lots of ugly, but he is so good to redeem that.
Yeah.
And what an honor that I have the ability to share with more women than most other women, because I can relate. I was there. I was a teen mom. I was in the sex industry. I've had two abortions. Most people can't relate to one of those things, but to be able to have the gift and the ability to share my heart with so many different areas of brokenness, I mean, that is a huge gift. And I cannot thank the Lord enough for allowing me and trusting me with the story that I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's your ministry now. He's given you a ministry you work for. You've mentioned CARE. Can you tell us about CARE?
Yes. So CARE is an abortion recovery and education ministry. Our sole purpose is to educate the community of the true consequences of abortion and to heal the men and women affected by abortion. And so we do that by abortion recovery Bible studies. We do help men. We do help more women because men are a little bit harder to reach. But it's lay counseling and weekend or weekly Bible studies. And again, it's just scripture. It's just scripture. But there's something special when you're doing it with a group of ladies that have done the same thing you've done. Their stories they're different, but ultimately it's resulted in an abortion, anywhere from one to multiple abortions. And we walk them through the journey of first accepting Christ's forgiveness. Now I say first, really not first, probably acknowledging is the first thing, acknowledging what you've done, the truth of the choice that you made, whether it was forced upon you or whether just in complete brokenness, you drove yourself to a clinic, acknowledging that you took the life of your child and forgiving those, including yourself, that had a role in that, and accepting forgiveness from Jesus Christ who died for your sin.
I'm imagining that I hope that there's somebody listening who is resonating with your story, that they maybe have held on to the secret of an abortion or multiple abortions, and your story and your courage to share makes them want to, like, they're done. They're ready to tell somebody and to deal with it and to heal. What would you say to her? What would be a good first step for her?
The first step is first realize you are not alone. I know that you're sitting in church every Sunday thinking you are the only one that's ever made this horrible choice. That's a lie. And as long as you are keeping it silent, Satan is keeping you in bondage and mm-hmm. limiting what you can do for the kingdom. So the first thing I would advise you to do is tell somebody, make the phone call, get on our website, send an email, reach out to somebody and just share with them, somebody that you can trust and that will hold your secret, but just tell somebody, because the moment those words leave your lips, healing begins.
Yes.
As long as the second light is shown, the darkness begins to fade away. I mean, it's instant. And the first time you speak out loud the choice that you made, however long ago, that begins your journey of healing.
Mm-hmm. And I will be sure and put a link in the show notes to this so people can click through and find this ministry that you're talking about, and also any resources that you would recommend that we could link to. I would also ask for those women and men who are listening who have not experienced abortion, what would you want them to know?
I would want them to know that so many people say, oh, abortion doesn't affect me. Well, you're living in darkness. You're fooling yourself if you think abortion doesn't affect you. Because with numbers of like 1 in 4 women that are post-abortive inside the church, everyone is affected. Somebody you love has chosen to abort their child. It may not have been you specifically, but your baby sister, your mom, your aunt, your cousin, your neighbor, your Sunday school teacher, your pastor's wife, somebody you love has chosen abortion. And so it does affect you. You just haven't seen the brokenness and you don't know how to deal with it. You don't want to look at it. So I just be aware that there is brokenness all around you and have compassion for those that don't know how to voice that yet.
That's really good. Well, thank you so much for telling your story. I know it's going to encourage and bless people who are listening. So thank you for your openness.
Thank you so much for letting me. This has been great.
In our conversation, BJ mentioned CARE, the ministry she's involved with. If you or someone you love needs help because of a past abortion, I've linked to CARE in the show notes, as well as some resources BJ often recommends or uses herself. Thanks so much for listening to By Faith, friends. I hope you're enjoying these conversations as much as I am. Next week, I will share my conversation with Taylor Harris. Taylor and I talked about the events that unfolded in our city, Charlottesville, Virginia, last August when the Unite the Right rally came to town, and about the larger picture of race in America. We also talk about how our faith in Christ informs our relationships across racial lines and informs our pursuit of justice. I hope you'll join me next week, and until then, have a great day and keep walking forward by faith.